Hey everyone, welcome to Meme Machine Talks, back for another wonderful episode, and this time I have a very special guest, someone who means a lot to me, and I'll explain why in a moment. But to explain a little bit more about Rob, I've done a short introduction which I'll roll into now. Working on titles such as Dirty Harry and Technocop, Rob Anderson has cemented himself in co-creating the game Moonstone, as well as other notable mentions, including Fiendish Freddy's Big Top of Fun, which I've streamed once, and it was interesting. The Incredible Crash Dummies, and modern games, including Iron Man 2. Rob's career has spanned over two decades, so let's learn a little bit more about the man who has created one of the best-known cult classics on the Amiga. Rob Anderson, welcome to Meme Machine Talks. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you, and thank you for that wonderful introduction. That's very little memory lane there. That's awesome.
Well, that's what I like to do is go right through the history and try to do as much research on my guests as possible. So, I mean, yeah, just from that list, there are some quite impressive games in that list. Fiendish Freddy's Big Top of Fun came up on a stream once that I did. I recently obtained an Amiga A600 from a friend of mine. And yeah, it was all great and everything was fine. And then I started to do a stream. I had a compact flash card inserted and had loads of games. And someone said, "Oh, playing Fiendish Freddy's." And I was going, "I've never heard of that." And then, yeah, that was an interesting stream.
Yeah. That's that was like one of my last sort of really favorite games that I animated on when I worked with Grey Matter. That was like, we were all inspired by Looney Tunes and just like really sort of squash squish, you know, type of stretch type of animation systems and stuff. So we were going all in on that whole thing. So that was a lot of fun to do.
good. Well, we'll talk about that in a minute. But what I'd like to actually do first, and I've done this with a few other guests, is actually pass the torch over to you to talk about any of your social medias or any projects or anything else that you've got going on, or where people can find out more about yourself.
Oh, sure. I'm not really much of a, when you say social media, I'm not really that engaged in social media, but I do have my Twitter account that I saw that you have followed. So that's wonderful. And I got a small website that's more of a portfolio for job search and stuff. It's not that exciting, but I usually go by the handle of Mr. Trog, being Trogs are the sort of like the first character that I animated for Moonstone. So it's kind of like the one character that's in all the encounter areas. So I sort of like, I don't know, adopted that character's name. And it's usually Mr. because Trog is usually taken as far as handles. I'm not sure what other people refer to a Trog as, but for me, it's kind of like, yeah, that's the one character that I remember doing. So as far as other works and stuff, I'm sort of doing a couple different things. I work with a company called CSUN Games, and I'm doing actually animation tools and pipelines and stuff. So not really design and stuff, but still something that I sort of flip-flop in between all the time, which is animation systems. I do enjoy writing those tools. Moonstone, for example, was a buildup of several tools that I had made, and that's what enabled me to do the animation I did in that game. So it's kind of something that I thoroughly enjoy kind of engaging in. And I've done, on hobby stuff, I'm really trying to, like, I've been primarily a coder for most of my past, 10 years or more. So I've been trying more to get back to my roots of animation again and stuff. So, and I have to admit, I'm having a great time just learning and using all these new open source tools, or just even purchased ones or whatever. There's just like from the old DPaint games, which I love DPaint. That was like my go-to tool. But some of the new stuff out there today that's free and stuff is just a blast to go through. So that's sort of a quick summary of sort of what I'm engaged in. I am working on slowly like reinventing Moonstone for the new generation of hardware and stuff. I've definitely received lots of information. When you talk about social media, actually, Rob Taylor, I'm not sure if you know him, but he runs the Moonstone Tavern website and has been like my biggest advocate to promote Moonstone to the world and say, hey, this is a great game and stuff. So I'm going to give a big shout out to Rob for that. So I've chatted with him a couple times, and he certainly has thrown me lots of kudos and information and saying, hey, you should check out this. Like, people have been sending me fan art, and I think that's a big flattery thing for me. Like, to have somebody like take something I did like many years ago and say, hey, you know, I really liked your game and I drew this and it's based on your character. And I'm like, wow, you have gone way above what I've done. And that is excellent work. So, and I try and send out, praise and thanks and stuff to people. That's generally what I use my Twitter account for, is just more or less to see what's out there in the game world of art and stuff, and just like some of the stuff people are doing is just amazing. So
it's funny you mentioned Deluxe Paint, because I've interviewed Stu Cambridge from Sensible Software, makers of Cannon Fodder and games as such, and Sensible Soccer. And it's so funny, because listening to his opinion of modern versus old, he still likes to go to the old, because it's part of his workflow and everything. But you could hear that he was trying to move away from using the old tech that he's got. But I guess when you've been so ingrained with it and he had so much success, it's very hard to make that transition. And I guess that's probably where some of the issues may lie, where obviously if you are trying to migrate Moonstone in its form from one platform to another, as you migrate over, obviously things like sprite and sizing and things like that obviously start to take a bit of a hit. And obviously trying to transfer one for one from an old tech to a new tech can lead to a lot of problems. A very recent example would be the I don't know if you've heard about the Blade Runner game, which is the point and click adventure game. It was recently well, I don't want to say remastered, because I don't think that's correct. I would say renewed. And part of the problem is a lot of the original assets were actually lost. So they were trying to take something that looks pretty rubbish and give it a HD boost. So for things like FMVs, you can use modern technology to boost from, you know, what would be deemed low quality video to 4K and do a relatively good job. But the original assets, you really struggle. And, I think it was a sad turn of events, because unfortunately it got absolutely slated in the press. I absolutely love the game. I think it's fantastic. But it was a real shame that I think the wording was incorrect. I don't think it should have been called remastered, or at least that was what they were portraying it to be. And the end result wasn't that. And that's why I said sometimes by taking the old and trying to give it a new lease of life can really have an issue where, if you don't get it right, you're going to get absolutely slaughtered in the press. Even though the game is fantastic. If no one's played the point-and-click adventure Blade Runner, please do. It's one of the finest point-and-click adventures ever made, in my opinion. Probably second to Monkey Island 2. But yeah, it just shows that sometimes if you try to make that transition and you don't get it right, you will get hit hard for it.
That is my biggest fear, actually. Yeah. I call it the George Lucas effect, because remember he did the prequels and everyone started slamming them and saying, stop ruining this for us. And I'm like, that's the last thing I want to hear. So
Perfect example. And, you know, the Blade Runner community are, well, incredibly divided, regardless of the game alone. I mean, the films divide people's opinion in the Blade Runner community. So to take something that's the only game that's kind of officially made, that's Blade Runner branded, and to, well, I think the upgrade that they have done is passable. I think a lot of people were expecting, you know, full fireworks and full fanfare, and what they got was a little bit disheartening. But to be honest, it was like £5, or I think it was like £9 when it came out. I mean, it's still not a lot for someone to take it and make it run on modern hardware. But anyway, I digress. We're not here to talk about that. We're here to talk about you. So what I normally do is try and go all the way back in time and run all the way through to the modern era. So So what was little Rob's life? Where did you grow up? What was your childhood like in terms of getting around computing? What was that like for you?
Oh, I was always fascinated with art. The small Rob was just like, that was like my go-to thing to do was drawing, sketching, coloring, whatever it was. And there was this point, being a kid of the, growing up in late 70s, early, mid 80s and stuff, we got the transition to computers. And I remember the computer lab appearing in the high school that I was at. And I was like, well, this is new. Like at the time it was ASCII art, which is terrible, but fun at the same time. But I just thought this was the neatest thing. And at that time, a friend of mine actually at school had an Atari 400 computer. And I just loved that thing. And I said, I'm doing whatever I can to get this computer. So I saved up my little money from my part-time job that I had and bought this computer and was fully engaged after that. I would do, on the Atari 400, there wasn't really a lot of drawing programs and stuff. So it was all done on graph paper. And then I would program that into the computer. So I was really down to like, I'm learning everything about this piece of hardware I can. So that was my introduction to computers. And after that, I was just like, this is what I want to do. And I think it's a wonderful thing that I actually managed to navigate my career to follow this sort of whole thing. But at first I was just really into art. I was like, I want to animate on this device. And I was just fascinated with some of the games I was seeing coming out on the Atari. So I was like, how do I do this? And especially with arcade games and stuff, there's a few shout outs that I would have to say that were like, Joust was like one of my favorites. And, Joust actually probably would be one of the influencers for the game that Moonstone became, because you could play against other people. And I always thought that was like so much fun, have a friend to play rather than the single player games and stuff. So, but yeah, so that's sort of where I went. And, from there I went into college and I was taking animation. At my first year of college, believe it or not, was programming business systems.
Interesting.
I was like, I want to take programming. So I said, oh, okay, well, I'll take this. And that programming classes were database, accounting, stuff like that. And I was like, I hated it. It was horrible. It was like,
I'm not surprised.
The worst thing I thought, why, you know, it just wasn't me. I'm glad there are people that enjoy it. Hats off to you guys and stuff, but it just wasn't my thing. And one of my teachers actually who taught C programming was, he said, you should really take the advanced course, because at that time I had programmed the Atari 400 in assembly language. So I kind of had a good sense of programming. So he was introducing me to that. But at that same time, my college also, which was Sheridan College, which is really popular for animation. It's in Oakville. When you ask where I grew up, it's Oakville, Ontario. And there's a college in Oakville, Ontario called Sheridan College that is highly sought after for the animation studios. Disney goes to recruit there and stuff. So I sort of saw what they were doing and I was like fascinated with that whole thing. So I dropped out of business computer systems programming class and joined animation, which is like a total to the other side of the campus, the entire thing. So I started to take that and I was really enjoying that. And at that point, a company called Gray Matter, who Chris Gray ran, and I knew Chris from high school, and he was one who him and his brother introduced me to the Atari. Anyways, he was actually starting to do video games at the time and he was doing well with it. And he actually was making money off of it. And what was the game he did? Infiltrator on the Commodore 64. And he said, hey, I'm making some new games. Would you be interested in doing some art? And so I started to actually work on an Atari ST for him part-time while going to school. But eventually it was a little overwhelming to do both. So I kind of stopped my animation career and just went full-time in with working with him. And sort of that's spawned a whole large amount of games. And it was all in the Toronto area, Oakville and stuff. So that was my humble beginnings of and my introduction to really doing it professionally and stuff. So I'm trying to think.
It must have been odd to be. I mean, I kind of have experienced a similar thing to yourself, where you start going down this route of programming for business and this kind of thing, and it's so far removed from where you actually end up. Here's an interesting question. Did you find any of what you had looked at or studied in that business sector become useful for anything that you have done?
No.
Okay. I had a feeling that was going to be the answer.
No, there was the only thing that was interesting in that is they made you take philosophy and psychology. And I found those two classes interesting for the discussions, quite taxing for amount of time to read. So there was a tremendous amount of stuff to read, but those were interesting. The rest of it was all just, let's see, what was the programming language? It was Pascal, COBOL, and it was basically really old school business stuff that governments still use today.
Yeah.
And it was like, take these classes and stuff. And I was like, oh, I hated COBOL. That was like the worst language. It was so formalized. It was, I was so used to assembly language. You take over the hardware. It's like, there's no rules. There's no OS. Yeah. It's just, here's the hardware and figure it out yourself type of thing. So when in assembly, you break it good. So
I remember doing Pascal, and I wouldn't say I'm a very competent programmer. I get the foundations of it, but the problem is that I had a very strange university career guidance path, that's probably a better word. So I initially started a course because a previous course that I had done, I thought I had failed two of the 8 modules, I think it was. And then part of the way through starting this course, I actually got contacted by the education board for this particular course, who said, hey, guess what? You actually passed. And I was like, oh, well, that kind of changes everything. So as quick as I could, I left that. I can't remember what it is. I think it's like a business. Was it a business programming and finance course, I think? Do you know what? Honestly, it was so long ago, I can't even remember. I just pushed it to the back of my mind. And then I started a animation and interactive media course because, you know, that's what I was interested in. So similar to you, I kind of like studied some of this stuff that I just had no interest in. And then suddenly I was like, oh, I can actually do the thing I wanted to now. Yay, let's go into that.
No, we've kind of gone the same path there. So it's like, no, we don't want that. So.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the just the word Pascal sends shivers down my spine. So I can relate. So so you said you had an Atari 400. At what point did you then start to work on or in and around an Amiga setup?
Oh, that was, so the 400 taught me programming and some art and stuff. And then I had seen the Amiga in the store, and I remember going to the store many times and seeing the Amiga, what was it? The 1000 at the time, but I ended up, my first one was the Atari, Amiga 2000. So that was my first one. I said, I'm going all in. I want that one. So that was the one I had to save up a bit of cash for that. So, once I had that, I was like, all in, and I was using that all the time for the art. And it wasn't that long after I started, like when I was doing that art, when I was leaving college, I was kind of a contractor at the time. So I had saved up enough money at that time to get one. And then when working at Gray Matter as well, they were using those systems as well to do Deluxe Paint.
I see. So Grey Matter was your first introduction to the Commodore Amiga, and then obviously, I guess, working in a business environment for gaming.
Yeah, it was the first professional, but I had a dream of buying it myself. So I did get one for myself before Grey Matter threw one. It was the Atari ST that they were using at first.
Right.
Which didn't have the nice colors that the Amiga did. It was still kind of a limited thing, and their sound chip was, I'm trying to remember, it wasn't that great.
Yeah, it's funny because there's another podcast called This Week in Retro, which I highly encourage you to listen to. And it's quite funny because two of the presenters are very much Amiga enthusiasts and the other guy is an ST enthusiast. And it's quite funny because they're constantly dropping jokes against each other where it's like, well, our graphics are better. And it's like, well, yeah, but your music sounds like trash. So, you know, it's this trade-off. So it's funny you said that because I'm not surprised they made the switch, but obviously I guess at the time from a professional business point of view, the ST was probably more of a less of a financial hit, but obviously the end result is that you can't be, I guess, as much more creative, and especially if you're doing animation and art, you need those colors, right? So I can understand why they made that switch.
That's exactly what, and I feel that the Atari group, who used to be Commodore, they flipped.
Yes.
But I think they sort of were like trying to be IBM. They were so gung-ho to sort of like be the business computer that's fun. And I was just like, no, wrong. It's Atari. It's like, no, stick to the roots. If you're going to use the Atari name, stick to your roots. Don't like try and reinvent it into Xerox or IBM or something like that, which I think that's what they kind of did wrong in the end. But, no, the Amiga with Deluxe Paint, especially Deluxe Paint 3, was like the one that they introduced the animation and everything. I was just like, oh, this is it. This is the one. So I was like, that. And I'm trying to remember some of the other software I used. There was some morphing software, which was the first time I ever had used that. And there was this image processing. And I wish I could remember the names of them. But NewTek created the video toaster. That thing was like the first time you sort of saw video cameras and digitizing abilities. I couldn't afford that one. That one's too expensive for my...
Just a little bit out of your cost range, just that much.
Yeah, it was too...
Although
too
actually much. It was that much.
I was more geared towards getting the de-interlacer card so that you could have I think I programmed on the Amiga for about 2 years without a de-interlacer. And I was...
Wow.
So it was kind of this jiggly screen at times. But luckily, when I started working on Moonstone, Mindscape said, you know, here, just take this card because you're killing us looking at it.
Thank you. That's the perfect segue. So how did the job at Moonstone come about? Was there, did someone reach out to you? Was there a job in a paper? The only reason I ask, because again, referring back to one of my other podcasts with Stu Cambridge, it was hilarious how he got the job at Sensible Studios. So, Sensible Software. So it will be fascinating to hear your take on how you got presented this particular job.
Yeah. So it's while I was working at Grey Matter, I took it upon myself. So to give you an idea, so some of the other background I have, as a kid, I played a lot of D&D with my friend Todd, who's also on the credit for Moonstone, and a few of my other friends, and we used to play that a lot. So Todd sort of came to me and says, hey, I have this idea for a game. I think it'd be a lot of fun. And he was more of, you know, just the strategy part, like the RPG aspect of it. He was like, here's the thing. Here's sort of this background where you just sort of go around, you get these keys, and then you got to go fight this thing at the end and you win them. And I was like, oh, okay. So I sort of ran with that and I said, well, I think it would be more fun if we did like combat, because I was into like a game like Barbarian, over here was called Iron Sword or something. I can't remember. It was a different name here. But so I was really into that. And I said, oh, maybe if we hybrided this together, kind of cool. So while I was still working at Grey Matter, at night I would go home and I would just do some of these animations and stuff. And I was putting together this sort of like presentation of just this, I'm going to simulate a combat in this little movie using D-Paint. And I sort of put together a 2-page design. And then Chris Gray, who ran Grey Matter, was good friends with all the guys at Mindscape. He had actually done lots of games with Mindscape. He represented us and he said, hey, why don't I introduce you to Mindscape? And being where he was with the status, he said, Rob's a good guy. He can do this. And after that, it was just a quick meeting, I believe, with Phil Harrison, who was at the time running the Mindscape studio in Burgess Hill in UK. And I think, who was the other one? Jeff Heath, who ran all of Mindscape. He owned it. Basically, we did it. It took about 2 weeks, and it was pretty well just a short little contract and a handshake type of thing. And they threw us a budget, which is laughable in today's terms.
But, go on. How much was it, if you can say?
I think it was
ballpark
shy of $40,000.
I see.
So it wasn't really a big risk project really for them. Well, I don't know, maybe back in that day that was kind of a big deal, because most games were done in seven to nine months, somewhere around there. So mine was a lot longer than that. I kept sort of like free flowing it a little too much. Yeah, so that's basically how the Moonstone sort of evolved. It was all kind of done in a sort of a quick sort of way like that. And then at that point, I had left Grey Matter and off I went and started working in my house. So, at my parents' house, actually.
Interesting. So here's an interesting question for you. So, and I probably already know the answer to this. Considering you had been exposed to the Atari interface as well as the Amiga interface, was it already set that you were immediately focused on this is going to be an Amiga release rather than any other system? Or was that down to more of the, I guess, the limitations of the others versus what you could potentially do on the Amiga?
I chose the Amiga because I was really just most comfortable with it.
Right.
And okay. The Atari, I didn't want to have anything to do with, because of the color limitations. So I was like, no, I
don't. My comments going, there's nothing wrong with you, tell me. Blah, 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 blah. But you go ahead. I'm an Amiga fanboy, so you carry on.
So I, at that time, at Grey Matter, for example, I had sort of established a solid animation pipeline that I could just do my work. Right. And there were some tools that I wanted to create. So in order to do the animation that I wanted for Moonstone, I knew these tools had to be written by me, or there wasn't really anyone. So I started to write tools at the same time. So I was kind of, I sort of had 3-4 jobs at the same time. I would like draw animation on paper. I would transfer my drawings over to the Amiga. I'd render them. Then I would say, oh, I got to update my animation tool so I can export it, put it into the code. And so I would, like I controlled all these different pieces of it.
Wow.
So I'd basically spend about 2 weeks drawing and coloring. And then I would spend about another 2 weeks doing the exporting and programming. And then I would go back, revise, and just keep circling and circling. And so I would do that for every character. And that was the biggest time consuming device. But you know, after you do like 2 characters, it starts to just become a rhythm. So it worked out quite well at the end. So, but that's kind of how my pipeline worked. And I definitely had help by there's a guy, Kevin Orr, that's listed on the credit. He was the more of the hardware, talked to the actual hardware, and he wrote some amazing tools for me. So basically he wrote it. So you throw out the Amiga OS, which took up 150 of your K of memory, which was very valuable to me. And he rewrote the whole OS so that I could just draw sprites and access the drives and controllers and stuff. And he wrote a remote debugger so I could program on my Amiga 2000, and I had an Amiga 500, and the 500 was my slave, and I could just debug remotely between the two systems. So,
wow, that's cool. Because I was just about to say, because if you've taken away the OS, how are you going to test stuff? You've been constantly going back and forth. That's very cool. Because I also come from a video editing background, and I've seen that done before, where you can literally have a computer with something else where the video is being pushed through so that you can see the final result whilst you're editing. So it sounds like you had a very sophisticated setup on a very, well, limited budget. That's very impressive. I'm quite taken back, actually. I'm like, okay.
Well, it was a lot of effort. And I will say that several of the people that I work with are extremely talented, and they cut me a little bit of leeway for my budget. Worked with Kevin before. Kevin did TechnoCop that you mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
And some of the artwork and stuff done by Dennis Turner was also Fiendish Freddy, TechnoCop. Well, Dennis was our resident expert animator. So, and if you look up Dennis, you'll see Dennis has gone on to do many great things. He worked with ILM, did lots of Star Wars and Star Trek. And I think now he actually is head of art in Sheridan College, actually. So He's like the head of the art department, inspiring young new minds how to move forward with stuff. But Dennis is like super talented. So
that's very cool. Okay, so you mentioned animation, and one thing that is probably most impressive about Moonstone is the death animations, because when I played it, I died a lot, which you were expecting me to say anyway. So how do I ask this question? Where did the idea for a lot of the, I guess, more gruesome death animations in the game come from? Is that through research? Is that just your own mind that's coming up with these? Was there like a film that you watched that you got some inspiration from? Where did that come from? Because some of them are just brilliant, and as simple as that.
Oh, thank you. Let's see. So definitely the Black Knight from The Holy Grail, Monty Python, The Holy Grail. That battle scene where he's cutting off the arms and everything, and I just love the blood squirts and stuff. So that was definitely an inspiration. Some of it was just childhood readings of Vlad the Impaler type of stuff. I don't know if you remember the spear where the trog spears you and then
yeah,
and then you just slide down.
Yes, I do. I've seen that animation quite a few times. Thanks for the memories.
Some of it was just me just sort of like taking the elements of what the attack was. And one of the things that I did with design was I wanted to make it as much fun to die as it was to win. So that you would kind of enjoy it. And I think maybe I got a little bit of that from this game called Battle Chess on the Amiga, where you took pieces and it was just so much fun to see how the piece destroys the other piece and stuff.
Sure.
And I thought that is a cool concept. It's just like you just almost want to try all the different combinations of things just to make it happen. So I really worked hard at sort of like coming up with different ways to kill the knight in some fashion. And a little bit of horror movie elements, definitely with the mud guys of the wetlands with the little organ sounds. And thanks to Richard Joseph for that. I said, I want a scare sound and maybe, you know, throw in sort of like the 30s, 40s movies, like a Hitchcocky type of thing where it's just like the sound is more terrifying than the actual act or something like that. So yeah, a lot of that stuff sort of came out of my imagination. I'll attribute D&D, playing D&D with my friends, and we would often sort of go into graphic detail of how we would kill each other, or how the monster, like when you're dungeon master, you're describing maybe how you're destroying the other character or something in graphic detail and stuff.
No, so, sure, I can appreciate that. I mean, I've seen Well, I've seen a lot of the death scenes, that's to say the least, and yeah, it's quite a gruesome game for those who haven't played it, but it's definitely a game that I think most people should go and play, especially if you own an Amiga. And I guess that kind of comes onto something else, which is how can I describe this? For me, I was very young when I was playing the game, probably too young to be playing it at the time, but I always thought it was a very successful game. And I guess one of the things, and through doing research, is it never really made it too far around the world, did it? I always wondered, and this was pre, you know, Mortal Kombat days, with the courts in America slamming down on violence and all of this crazy stuff. Do you think that the violence actually hindered the game being bigger than what it could have been or what it became?
I don't think it would have been a game without the violence. I think it's complementary to what the game is. Like, I remember Mindscape asking me about the blood. They were squeamish of it.
Right.
And that's actually why it used to be just called Moonstone, but it was Mindscape that said, we should add A Hard Day's Night, because they thought it was a nice pun that would lighten the mood. I never really was a big fan of that, but they thought it would really help. And I was like, okay, you know, being sort of like my first game, I'm like not going to be too debating with them over the name, but I like the simplicity of just Moonstone. But anyway, so we put in the gore switch to sort of appease them too. And I don't know if anyone ever played the game. That could be a good poll. Who played the game without the gore?
Yeah, I might try that one on Twitter actually and see.
I would be curious to know if anyone really did that, because anyways, that took a lot of filtering for me to now filter all the gore out of this for that one switch.
Yeah.
And stuff. But you still... So I'm trying to remember what I did. I think I turned off the beheadings, which I thought were so much fun. But,
I agree.
I don't think it would have been a good game otherwise. It would have just been a typical RPG game, you know, not really much else to it. It should just be a board game at that point, more or less.
Sure.
It didn't have the gore. Like, I think the combat was what sort of set it apart from other RPGs or like D&Ds and stuff like that.
I agree.
Yeah, the whole thing with it was a pre-Mortal Kombat game, and sort of Mortal Kombat sort of opened the doors for a lot of gore, I think, and I did like the game Mortal Kombat. I am not a very good Twitch player, which is the button combo. So I was terrible, but I used to like to watch people playing it in the arcade. You know, it used to be the arcade game that people would gather around and watch the really good person play it. So you sort of see it for what it is. So that game actually, with its popularity, made Nintendo and Sega change their thinking a little bit and bend the rules. But Moonstone was presented to both Nintendo and Sega, and they both really did like it, but they said it's too violent for our audiences at this time. So that's why it never reached North America. North America said, if we don't get Nintendo or Sega, then there's no point in us putting a marketing budget behind this product.
Wow.
So that was the unfortunate thing with Moonstone. So it never reached North American shores. So it was primarily a European game. Mm. And Britain was probably the most popular. And I'm not so, yeah.
Coach Bear here.
And Germany is notorious for banning violent games. So it did hit that mark. However, the joke, I just think it's funny, because when you ban something, it tends to attract more interest. So, and
exactly.
Germany was notorious for its pirating abilities. And I think it was a German board that had the game up on their pirate boards in like shy of 2 weeks, something like that, in the release. And I was like, well, there it is. So
congratulations, guys. You've played yourself. Well done.
Yes. So I was like, well, there it is. Thanks, guys. But Yeah.
I think you touched on something interesting, actually, and it would be interesting to get your view on it. Xcopy was always owned by a lot of different people who had Amigas, and I know you know what Xcopy is. Mm-hmm. As someone who has spent most of his life making games, and you know, you've obviously made Moonstone, to see your own game being pirated, what's the internal fight that you have? Because obviously people are enjoying your game, but you're not getting the monetary reward. Do you have like this internal conflict with those two things? It'd be interesting to get your view on it.
Yeah, it's discouraging, because I'll say Moonstone was not a financial success for me. It didn't have a large development budget, and the sales were flat, which is why there was never a sequel, because they talked about it, and I designed it, and they just said, well, the sales weren't there. So it was kind of a curse for me because of that. So do I blame the pirates? No, not really. Because a lot of the people that use pirate boards generally don't buy games anyways. So, yeah. And I'm not sure if the point is that they don't buy them because they don't want to, they wouldn't do it because they have no money. I think I do have the money. Some people just do it because they can, more or less. But for me, it's a duality of, I get it. I don't think there's any way around it at this point in the world of software. There'll always be someone that'll pirate stuff. Hopefully the companies that publish the games have an incentive to sort of try and market it so that people do buy it in some sense of the word. So I think it's a symbiotic relationship with the developer and the publisher to sort of say, hey, publisher, it's up to you to sort of like deal with that aspect and help the sales and stuff. But I've certainly met a few people in my day that I did not agree with, where they just said, a game is only worth the price of the disc it's on. And I was like, ouch, you have obviously not worked over 2 years on a project and put in a lot of time of your to do something to think that it's only worth a dollar or something like that, like the price of the disc. So I found that a little offensive, but.
No, I agree there. I think, I do agree with that statement. And you can't quite compare the two, but a friend of the channel, Retro Ravi from the Retro Hour, I think he co-helps make a recent or a modern Amiga magazine. And it's funny because he actually put on Twitter the other day, or I think it might have been on Facebook, I can't believe people are taking my magazine and pirating it and basically making digital copy, taking the digital version and uploading it for others to enjoy. And I'm thinking, Christ, this is a magazine, you know? Like, I mean, it isn't, like, bank-breaking, you know? So, as you said, any medium where someone can, I guess, get it for free will be taken advantage of. I guess the thing that I've seen recently that I've seen a lot of indie developers do is sell their software with whatever price they want. So they will literally have a website with an empty shopping cart. You pay what you think. And it's like, I can get why you do that. I guess if it's a single person who's worked on that project, then, you know, any money that comes in is great. But for instance, in Moonstone's case, you had a budget, you had a company behind you, there's multiple people. And as you said, you've invented things for this passion project, and for it to be pirated, I can understand you being incredibly hurt by that, because obviously you've put an incredibly amount of time. If you know, you had spent a couple of months and you said, you know, it's a game I've put out there, cool, whatever, no biggie, then that's fine. But as you said, I think when you come down to a labor of love that's then taken advantage of because basically someone couldn't be bothered to go and buy it.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's disheartening.
Yeah. It's like I did 2 years to develop Moonstone. So that's a significant amount of time. But on the subject though, I do think that today's world has this incredible new way of doing things for finances. Like, I would certainly be discouraged if I went out and bought a game like back in the day and I hated it and I spent like $30. I think it was $30 back then, and you can't get a refund or anything. And I can sort of see a point. in today's world with the e-commerce and stuff, there is new ways to sort of like say, here's a tryout game. And if you like it, you can tip me, like you said, you know, oh, pay what you want. And there are people that are more spoiled, like with Kickstarters and stuff. And you know, certain websites are like Patreon and stuff that you can just tip the developer and say, hey, I really liked your game. I, you know, something. And so there's all these new avenues to basically sort of get around those old arguments of, you know, where the store says it's sold, no refunds and stuff. And it's like, but I hate this game. It sucks. It's got bugs. Or, you know, that's the worst thing is if you buy a game and it's got bugs. And Moonstone did have a bad bug in it when it first got.
Oh, really? Oh, yes. Now this is something I wasn't aware of. Do tell.
Oh, well. Okay, I'll give you a bit of backstory. So basically, Moonstone, I think, had 2 days of testing before it went to press, like print.
Wow. Okay.
And the guys were working overnight, but like to try and solve. But there was this one bug that if you went to the, and I hated this bug, and I cringe now thinking about it because it's a stupid mistake on my part. But anyways, what would happen is you would go to the UI where you could collect or steal items on the inventory, and the dagger wouldn't move anymore. It would just be frozen. Oh. And so you basically the game's dead at that point because you can't exit. There was no key. There was no shortcut.
That's right. You just
say exit. And I fixed that, I think, a week after the press. And then they updated the releases of stuff. So they would swap out the disc for you. But I think one of the pirate boards to and I laugh now, but at the same time, I was offended. But one of the pirate guys says, Moonstone pirated with bug fixed. And I was
wow.
like, how did you fix it? So... You didn't even have the code. He obviously just, you know, just
taken the other version of
it, figured out where it was and then fixed it. So anyway,
wow.
That's an admission.
Piracy. It's not always bad.
No. In that case, I'm like, oh man, you should be writing games if you can do that type of stuff.
Exactly. So. But you know, these things happen. I've seen it with modern gaming where they test and test and test and they put hours of tests and international versions and people all around the world, and then it comes out and there's that one guy who will just take that one route that you've never tested, and then all of a sudden whole game is broken. You're like, how did we not spot it? We've got $1 million budget on testing. How did we not get it? It's like, well, this one guy did it, so on you. But you know what, I think that adds a bit of honesty to it, because I think a lot of, I guess, indie devs would probably try and stay away from mentioning that. So I appreciate you talking about that, because I had no idea. Fortunately, I've never experienced that bug. So I guess I've got away with one. As you mentioned releases, have you seen how much boxed copies of Moonstone go for on eBay?
I have seen that they go for a lot of money.
Yes, I was about to say that. Eye-watering amounts. Because it was funny, because I hadn't looked for a while, and I told a few of my community that you're going to be on the podcast, and they were very excited. So I can't wait for them to listen to this. And then they said, can you ask Rob to make new versions to bring the copies of Moonstone down on eBay? And I went, is it that bad? And they went, can I have a look? And I was like, oh, yes. It is quite a lot, isn't it? Oh, so the last one I saw, I've seen one listed for 500. I've seen another one that is apparently sealed. I don't know how much truth is in that, for about £800, which is
wow,
eye-watering. So, I don't think I'll be getting a copy again anytime soon, which does hurt a little bit. But anyway, that brings us on to something else, because you mentioned you're trying to renew Moonstone from the modern era.
Yes.
So how far are we in that production, and when are we going to see it? Because now you've got my interest level like up here at the moment. So
I don't really have a date specified, and actually where I'm at is sort of I've done some demos with some of the new modern engines to create things. But so to start off, I have my big box of original artwork that I used for Moonstone, and it's all okay. hand-drawn, hand-drawn, so I've scanned most of those original drawings into the computer. So it's a tribute to the existing design, but I don't want it just to be a reskin. But it's hard to sort of describe because I'm still trying to develop a look and feel that makes me happy.
Sure.
And that's why I've probably frustrated some people wondering where is it, where's the demo and stuff. And I'm like, yeah, I still don't like the way I'm drawing. Like I'm rusty compared to when I did the original. So I'm still trying to establish my my flow again. Luckily, I can still draw the knight. So it's just one of those characters that I drew so many times that it's like a reflex for me. But so it's a tribute to the original. I'm not changing the design so much, but I do want to add in a lot of the features that I couldn't do for the original due to lack of disk space, memory, just time, really. Like I already extended the project probably about 9 months, 10 months past its original sort of deadline. So Mindscape was patient with me. So having a crunch schedule sometimes brings out the best because you end up taking, you get innovative and sort of like, well, it has to be this, otherwise get rid of the whole thing. So how can I do this feature without spending 2 months on it or something like that? Can I do it in a week? So some of that is like that. So the game will be sort of a tribute to the original. I've taken to heart some of the features I want. I'm still looking for the animation style. It will be not 3D. Some people have asked, but you know, I've worked on lots of 3D titles and I don't think I could get the look and feel that Moonstone should have without, like, you could, but it would require a massive team of really good technical 3D people to sort of pull together the cloth and the hair and all that stuff. But so I'm sort of like relying on traditional 2D animation to do it. And I think that's actually better because rigid skeletons and 3D and stuff are really great for a lot of reasons. But I think for Moonstone, I still want to sort of have that little bit of traditional animation and the flexibility of a pencil or like, you know, an artist's interpretation to do the extra squash and squish. Like there's a few people that, who was it? Aaron Blaze is a Disney animator that worked on The Lion King. And his comments when he saw the 3D version of The Lion King from Jon Favreau, he was not pleased. He did the original some of the main characters of The Lion King, and he was kind of discouraged at how static and everything he felt it looked compared to the hand-drawn nuances that he was able to bring and stuff. So maybe he's biased because he did the original. It's like this Favreau is just like reinventing, you know, typical rebranding of stuff. So I'm trying to create something really good in that sense of the word. I've described it as maybe a living painting, maybe that type of thing, but I, you know, that's too far, but. So unfortunately, I don't really have a date. I have started and stopped Moonstone Remake about four times at this point. So I keep going back and forth. So it's something I want to do. I've certainly know it's well overdue to sort of pull it together. I think it was like 10 years ago. I was getting pinged by a few fans saying, hey, can you, what's happening with this? Is there something I'd really love to play it? Some people said, start a Kickstarter. And I'm like, oh yeah, I could maybe start a Kickstarter or something like that to get some funding and things. But I'm not quite ready for that level of commitment. So hopefully by the end of this year, I might have something to present on my Twitter or something like that.
Okay, well, that's an idea, and I'm more than welcome to present it on my Twitch streams as well, because people have seen me die a multitude on Twitch on Moonstone, so I would love to do it all over again. I think, and I've said this before, there's two things I'm going to say. The first one is that I've always said that if you constrain yourself, whether it be time or technology or anything else, it really does breed creativity by having a fixed boundary of whatever you need to set. And I've seen it before. I've seen games that go on and on and on and on. And if they just put a hard line in and said, this is it, you know, we've got to get this out the door. Because the problem is as, you know all too well, as technology moves, it moves at such a fast pace that by the time you think you're there, something comes out which then replaces that and you go, crap, I've now got to catch up to this level. So then you've got to spend all that dev time catching up. And by the time you get there, then it's moved on again. You go, shit, now I've got to carry on with everything else. So I think there is a lot to be said about setting yourself boundaries. But one of the best things to happen in modern, if you want to class it, modern retro gaming is the rebirth of side-scrolling beat-em-ups.
Yeah.
Things like Streets of Rage 4, the new Turtles game, there are a multitude of side-scrolling beat-em-ups that have come out recently that are absolutely excellent 2D beat-em-ups, but just really capture everything. And I remember when the Streets of Rage 4 announcement came out and everybody went, oh, here we go. I bet it's going to be rubbish. They're not going to keep the style. It's going to look terrible. It's going to play terrible. This guy said that as well, because it always makes you concerned that you're going to take something that people ultimately love and bring it into the new world. Is that transition going to work? And they did an absolutely brilliant job with it. There are still people who think that maybe the art style isn't complementary of the previous, but I think there has to be a push to the future, right? I mean, yeah, you can look at things with, you know, rose-tinted goggles and nostalgia goggles and say, oh, but it doesn't look like the original. It's no good. Well, do you know what? You're talking to a whole new generation of people on a brand new platform. There's got to be some elements of new added to it. And I think the, I guess, comic stroke cel-shaded effect that they kind of went through with Streets of Rage 4, just it really captured the old and the new really nicely. It kind of brought it to life in like a comic book style. And I guess, you know, again, I don't know if that's the style that you're kind of going after, but it just shows that sometimes you have to bite the bullet and say, do you know what? Throw the dart and say that is what it is, and that's sticking. And another perfect example of this is the new Monkey Island that's coming out. And it was horrific to see some of the comments that were coming back on Twitter where people were like, oh, this doesn't look like the original. Oh, I don't like this style. Man, man, man. It's, why is it not 3D? And it's like, well, you can't cater for how many millions of people have played the old one, because you're trying to reboot something into the modern day. And if you keep doing the old, you don't change anything for the future, if that makes sense. So I was very disappointed in a lot of people's feedback. I think the game is going to do brilliantly well. From a nostalgia point of view, I think anyone who's ever seen, heard, touched, smelt Monkey Island will definitely go and buy it. But I really hope that with the new art style, it starts to bring new people to point-and-click adventures. And again, that's probably another game genre that's massively had a fire lit up under its buttocks recently, which is the point-and-click adventure, where loads of indie developers are making it. But there, it's funny because a lot of the indie developers are focusing majorly on pixel art graphics, but there are some that have gone completely 180 and are doing these incredibly detailed 2D sprites and animations. One very interesting point and click adventure game, if you've not played it, is called Chicken Police, and it's it's hilarious. It's all 2D art, and yes, as you can imagine, you play as a chicken or a rooster that is a police officer, but everyone else in the game is like an animal that's got a human body. But it's done in such a brilliant presentation, and it's so different but so cool at the same time. Oh, nice. So I kind of hope that with Moonstone you do keep some of that old, but you don't get too put off by the new, because do you know what, there will be people who will say, oh, but it doesn't look like the original. Well, it's not being the original, it's a whole new take on it, right? Yes. But here's something, and I kind of hope you do this, because I've seen a couple of other games, is to have a button where you can switch the graphics. That would be amazing.
I have seen, what was it, the last Mario World had the, remember you could go to retro 8-bit and then back to the, yeah. No, that, I have had someone actually say that, if you do a re-release, could you have the original embedded into the whole thing? And it's like, well, that would be pretty cool to do, so.
I think one of the best example I've seen of that in modern times actually was Another World. It was the 20th anniversary one that they did, where they kind of, again, similar thing. They brought it to modern life. You hit a button, you go, oh, that's what it used to look like. Now I get it.
Yes. I saw your Twitch, I think, of you playing Another World just recently. And I was like, oh, I remember that. Oh, I played that thing. That game was so hard at some points. It's just... it seems so simple, and it's incredibly timed perfectly. And that's what I call one of those games you throw your joystick out of frustration. Oh, damn it.
well, that is a very good question, because there is a very important question that I've got on my list next to me, which is, what is your favorite Amiga joystick? A very important question.
It has to be the original Atari 8, eight direction with one button. That's good, the one I use forever and ever. I don't know. It's just maybe something that I used as a kid, so it just sort of stuck with me. But that thing was just awesome.
Yeah, it's funny because I'm just looking up at my shelf here, and I've got like a collection of specifically Amiga joysticks up here, and I look at it, and I've got like the Konix Speed King, which I still say is the best joystick of all time. People are going to go crazy in chat, but I don't care. What else have I got there? The Cheetah Bug, which is about that big, that you would hold like this, and it's kind of got like an analog stick. But do you know what I liked? Micro switches. Why can't companies bring back more micro switch bloody control pads? It was the best. It was the best. I mean, I've got an arcade stick here. I think this has got, hang on.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
It's got some micro switch, but I like the big loud clicky ones that you used to get on the Amiga, a big stick and just clonk, because you knew you were making connection there. And especially when you're playing a game like Moonstone, you need to make sure you've got that direction, because if you don't, you're going to die. And this guy died a lot.
I developed it all with the Atari joystick. That was that I used that through the whole thing. So for some reason, I never upgraded my joysticks at all.
Bulletproof joysticks through the years. Have you still got it though?
No.
Damn.
That's one of my regrets, is I don't have my Atari 2000 or Amiga 2000 anymore, or the all the discs that I used to have for Amiga. Oh, wow. Although I don't. They would work anymore after all these years, probably. But one too many moves and keep down, getting smaller and smaller places and stuff. So,
sure.
I don't have the original Amiga that I developed anymore. So, and to be honest, I think I donated it to the Salvation Army. So, to get rid of it.
Well, hopefully somebody's still got it. I'd be devastated to learn if that thing's got into landfill or something like that. It's funny you mentioned about Amiga disc degrading, because I had a friend of mine, and he sent me a ton of discs, one of which is quite comical, and I need to send it away, and I'll explain why in a moment. He sent me like Cannon Fodder Boxed and a few other different games. I was hoping for Moonstone, but alas, it wasn't there. And I went through and I pulled my A600 out, and I was going through the disc, and I was like, that's dead, that's dead. Oh, that works, that's good. Oh, it loads halfway and dies. Went through that. So it's just amazing how many discs are degrading. But there was one disc, and it's quite funny, and you will laugh, because all it says on it is sex partners, and in brackets it says 18. Now, I can't get it to load, and I'm very disappointed. So I don't know if it was some random obscure game or whether it's a list of someone's conquests of women. I haven't discovered yet. We will find out at some point, because I need to find out what's on that disc, because it's been haunting me for ages. It's probably blank and someone's blanked it off. But yeah, it was just, as I was going through, I was like, what on earth is this? And it was so funny because my stream, everyone in my chat was like, hey, put it in the A600. Let's see what's on it. And I'm like, well, I'm going to blank the screen off first and see if this thing loads. And it didn't. I was like, damn. Like, it was like the only time I'd ever been torn where I wanted something to work and didn't at the same time. So, but yeah, this degradation is a sad thing to see. And also cassette tapes as well. I mean, cassette tapes in the UK for our 8-bit micros, I mean, they are degrading so quick. But even for those, again, a friend of the channel, Neil from RMC Retro, has done a brilliant job of taking his entire collection of cassette tapes and backing those up digitally. And then he's got this crazy method where, for instance, on his Spectrums and some of the other 8-bit micros, has got like this device that plugs into like the headphone port, and you push play and it kind of plays the digital audio through and goes into the system and still runs like normal. And I was like, what is this wizardry? this is amazing. This shouldn't work, but it does. But yeah, it's sad to see these old things that we love so much. I mean, in fact, in that box up there, I've got a copy of, I think, Monkey Island 2 on 4 discs, and I don't dare want to put them in the machine just in case it garbles it up. But at the same time, I'm like, I don't want you to die, but you will. So I look at the outside cover like, I still love you, but I can't use these, so it's fine. But yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. Again, as I said, that the old tech that we still hold on to has been given this, I guess, modern lease of life. And I really hope that you do find the time and the overall desire to finish this Moonstone remake, because, you know, even as a child, there are 4 or 5 games that stand out, but Moonstone will always stand out as being one of the most fun and hilarious games that I have ever played on the Amiga, without question. It's brilliant. And I encourage anyone who owns an Amiga or hasn't played the game to go out there and somehow find a way to play it, because it is just fantastic. Maybe not pay the £500 or £800 that some people are offering, but I'm sure you can find a way to play it.
The PC version's on GOG.
It? Oh, okay.
Yeah. So you can get the PC version. The Amiga version, there's a legal issue with who owns the Amiga OS nowadays. So there's it's not possible to sort of just put it out there. So
sure,
but that's unfortunate when I found that out, because I was like, oh, can't we do that as well? The Amiga version has better sound and stuff. So, and I didn't code the PC version. It was a port done by a couple guys that Mindscape.
Oh, okay. Oh.
And they did a pretty good job, but PC being what it was, you know, at that time, it wasn't quite so, well, there's so many configurations, it's difficult to program on a PC in those days. So, yeah, Sound Blaster cards, EGA, CGA, VGA.
It's so funny because I remember talking to someone not so long ago who I guess wasn't exposed to the Amiga or PC scene at that time period. And I said to him, I said, do you understand how difficult it was for PC game devs to go, okay, and which graphics are we going to use? Well, which graphics card's in the machine? I guess we're going with that one then. And it was like, yeah, but there's like 15 other different versions you could pick from that are not compatible with each other.
Yes.
God damn it, people. Can we just unite on one thing?
Yes. No, I will say this. The evolution of computers to where we are today, indie developers have so many great things resolved that they don't have to even think about anymore.
I agree.
Like, if just to get art out of an art package back in the day, you sort of had to know the file format. You had to reverse engineer the file format to get it into your file format. And now today, it's just all standardized. It's so nice just to not have to think about any of that.
I'll tell you something funny. Literally the other day, what was I doing? Oh, that was it. I wanted to convert or rip the audio out of a video that I was using for actually another podcast. And I could have opened Premiere and I could have just put the video in and exported as an MP3. I was so lazy that I opened a web browser and said MP4 to MP3, hit return. I went, oh, there seems to be a website. Upload, click, download. Right, done. And I was like, and then I sat there and went, Christ, hang on a minute. How long would this have taken someone like 10, 15 years ago? And I was like, I've just done this in about 30 seconds. That's really scary because it literally would have taken me more time to literally open up a whole new Premiere project and drag this thing in and then set everything. And I was just like, right, okay. Oh, good. The web does everything again. That's easy.
It's so nice today. Like in game engines too, Unity and Unreal are just available to you and they do so much of your work that you can just dive right into, I'm just going to start doing my design in the game. I don't have to think about all these pipelines and stuff. And I'm working with 3D now too. And it's like, even that's all being standardized to a large extent. Before, I just remember at Gray Matter when we would have to do these intense pipelines and reverse engineer Maya or Alias at the time, Alias Wavefront and Softimage. And there's these guys that just look at file formats and try and dissect where the polygons are stored and how do you get them and how do you get the texture inference. And it's like, now it's like, oh, it's all there for you. So
it's, indie developers, you know what?
You have a nice road ahead of you to just be able to say, I have a great game idea and you can just go for it. So
it's true. And I think that's a beautiful thing that, to make a game now has never been easier. But again, there is that hint, as I said before, and I've said this before actually on my last podcast about video making, where to make a decent video now is very easy because most mobile phones are 4K, so you've got that sorted. Most microphones, you could go on Amazon and buy a relatively cheap lapel mic that will do a perfectly good job for like £20-30. So you've already got the video and the audio sorted. All you need is the creativity. And the problem is because there's no boundaries, people just they don't focus the energy into one area. And I think you mentioned a very good point, because I came from an animation background and I've used Maya or Maya, however you want to pronounce it, before. And during my course, it was, you know, teaching you how to build a skeleton and then, you know, rigging that skeleton to a model and then doing all the textures and getting all the mapping correctly. And, you know, if you want to do hair, forget it, because the PC isn't powerful enough to render it.
Right.
So you sit there and you go, how easy is it now? And I did this the other day. I said, how easy is it for me to start from scratch, get a character and animate it? And I was shocked at how simple it is. To there's so many packages out there. I used to use one a long time ago. I think it was called, was it Poser 3D? I think it was called. So you could build a model, for instance, externally, bring that into this piece of software, and it would literally just snap all the body parts together. And to make like a running scene, would literally go, make this character run, click. Okay, I'm running now. Cool, that's an animation done. And then, you know, how much do you want the person's gait to run offset or something like that? So, you know, if someone had been shot, you could offset their gait so they run a bit different. I thought, this would have taken me like a whole university module to do. And I've just done this in 10 minutes. I'm like, it shouldn't be this easy, but it's cool that it is.
It is. I love the amount. Well, the internet in that regard is so much great reference material. So much like what you said, just like, oh, I can just piece this together. Someone's already posted free motion capture and I can just import it into this thing. And look, I can just rent. I'm like, wow, this is just so wonderful. So
I think the other useful thing is that when it comes to things like problem solving and troubleshooting, as you said, you had to rely on friends or friends of friends or friends who worked in the building that you happen to be in. Whereas now you can just go, why doesn't this work in Unreal Engine? I don't get it.
Click. Stack Overflow. Yeah,
exactly. How does this work? Right, that's it. Done. Yeah. So
whatever problem I have, someone else has had it and probably written it up on the internet somewhere. So yeah, it's kind of a fun time I find for development of these days. So yeah.
So moving on from Moonstone into more of your, I guess, modern day game making and design, was there Was there lots of things that you had learned in your, I guess, previous time making games that were very useful into making modern games in terms of your knowledge and processes and stuff? Was there much that you brought over from, I guess, to quote a term, old game making versus new game making?
Yeah, it, I definitely can say that because of the old days, teams were small and you wore many hats. So you got exposed to the programming, the art, the management, the, you know, sales, you meet the publishers and stuff. Today's world, most of the people bring in today's teams, you know, are very sort of like task centric, you know, here's your tasks and here's your thing. And there's not a lot of, they basically have little, you know, like, development directors that sort of go between the different people to sort of orchestrate. So you're not like involved with all those things. So I think for me, it's just, I can relate. I can say, oh, I've walked in the shoes of the animator. I've walked in the shoes of the designer. I've done the testing. I've done the publishing part. I've done production management. I've sort of done all these different pieces. And so that's, I think, advantageous for me because, I can relate to a lot of the people that I work with and what their jobs are and stuff. Like the hardest thing for me was when I went from hands-on development, programming and art to producing, when I was actually the producer and in charge of the team, because it's a different discipline where you're then now sort of delegating other people to do tasks. And all that you can do is say, this is what I want. But for me, because I had done the programming and stuff, I can relate to what those people are going to have to do and how hard it can be. Or the, you know, I used to always say, it's like my old joke was we would just used to say, take 2 weeks to do this task. That was the go-to thing, 2 weeks. And then a week later, it's like, how long is that task going to? 2 weeks. It's always 2 weeks. I think there was a line in that movie Snatch with when Turkish was asking when the sausages are going to be done.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking.
5 minutes. And it's like, wait, that doesn't make any sense. So I laughed when I saw that. I said, I think I've used that line before. So that was quite funny. So Guy Ritchie, I guess, has probably written that, or some, whoever his writers were at the time. But so yeah, I think I sort of bring some things forth. But the biggest thing is, because I've done design, I think when I've done programming and other companies and stuff like that, I think I've been helpful in the sense of being able to relate and say I sort of see what you're going for, and so I can sort of like keep up with it. It's not like, could you write me a full design and tech spec and implementation and stuff? I'm like, okay, I get what you're saying. So like one of the producers at EA when I worked at Electronic Arts, he liked me a lot because he says, you don't seem to ever argue about what I'm trying to get. And so, but I sort of see, you know, we're all trying to achieve the same goal. I'm not trying to defeat you here or something like
that.
Of
course.
It's like, you know, we want a great game and it's all good. And I want to make sure that you're happy. I want you to be happy, you know, that type of thing. So it's kind of you know, we're all on the same mission here. Hmm. Except when I have to work, like, you know, without sleep, that's I get a little tired at a certain point. So.
No, but I'm sure. And that's a very good point you've raised, because I think if you go into any project, and it can be any project, if there is an opinion of where the direction is going that isn't the same as everybody else, it completely derails it, because you suddenly go, well, why are they saying that? Is there something that's wrong with the project? Because, as you said, you know, it may be not having resistance, but unless everybody's pulling in the same direction, having that same vision and everybody's got the same goal, by having that internal conflict can completely derail a project. Yeah. Completely derail it.
Yeah, it could. I've certainly been on some projects where the team starts getting divided and it starts getting more and more difficult to sort of like move forward because there's too much debate about what, and I get upset sometimes with management because management's job is to make the definitive choice and have everyone move forward. And it's, and I find some management don't do that, and they think it's healthy to have this free for all and sort of pit the two sides of the team against each other. And I'm like, no, that's not good. So what
much I like find, Moonstone.
What's that?
Much well, like Moonstone, just put them head to head and cut each other's head off.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, Moonstone, I had the luxury of I was the guy. I was the programmer, the artist, and I was on the design. So I'd argue with myself maybe, but. But there were some times I think, yeah, it would have been helpful maybe to have someone just say, just get this done. Well, Mindscape did eventually say, we have to release this. So fly out to England and get this done. So, but on the other side of things, yeah, the divided team is starts getting kind of tough. But my approach to design, and I certain Japanese companies tended to try and like lock in a certain design at the beginning before anything's written. And I'm like, you can't do that because you don't know if it will work. As much as much research as you have done and saying, oh, it's a bit of this game, it's a bit of this game, and a bit, yeah, but you don't know if all those games melded together with this team is going to be good. And so it's kind of, what's his name? Mark Cerny, I believe, who was, one of Sony's big guys, Crash Bandicoot guy. But he came to work with EA for a little bit, and I got to interact with him a bit. But yeah, he was sort of like, and who was the other guy? The guy of Shiny Entertainment. Those guys were just like, what's the hook? Like, you got to have that hook, as they say, or even in Hollywood stories, it's like, what's the hook of this thing? Why do I want to play it? What's interesting about this? So they would say, you got to develop that first, get people excited about that, and then you can build out from that. And Cerny was all about that particular. He would create the sandbox level that's going to emphasize all the hooks and where you can do it. And Shiny Entertainment, one of my favorite games was Earthworm Jim, which was a classic platformer. Fantastic animation, but yeah, the hook was the worm being able to use his head as a whip,
yeah.
And grab things and lunge everywhere. And so I was like, yeah, so that was their hook. It was like, this is the hook of the characters. And then they build out from that feature. And I think sometimes certain game development studios get too locked in on a certain thing and it's not working. Then they start to panic and they start throwing more people at it, thinking that will solve it. And that makes things worse because now you got new ideas and it's just like all divided at that point. So it's a tough one. Like I've certainly worked with amateurs. I won't say amateurs. I'll say rookie producers that have never done it. They've, you know, sort of being promoted up the ranks from maybe test, or maybe they just came from another industry altogether. And they sort of come in with these ideas, but they don't really know what to do. And they don't know how to talk to tech people because tech people tend to be very detailed about what they're doing. And it just throws off because producer is more like, this is the big picture, and this guy's saying, I'm just talking about this one small thing. So anyways, yeah, so I think that's what I sort of move forward with in some of the things I sort of get what they're asking, and sort of like, they're not looking for a great detailed argument or something like that. They're sort of like, can you do this, because I think this is what would be good. But sometimes, you know, you do get these odd questions where it's like, I'm not sure why you want to do that. It's like, you know, you're playing this sort of like certain type of game. And then they say, I played this other game the other night and I think it's great. And we should bring in the, and it's like, what? Wait, no, that's a different game entirely. Why are you thinking that? I get it. You like it. It's a good game, but no, it doesn't work with this. So
sure.
I think my favorite thing was my favorite statement from a producer at EA was, I was working on Triple Play Baseball, and they said, we need to make a baseball game that will appeal to people that don't like baseball. And I was just like, what? That doesn't make any sense. So please explain what you have in mind here. So, but they were trying to obviously increase sales, expand
sure.
and stuff. And I get what they're saying. They tapped out on their audience. So we ended up doing the home run derby thing, thinking that that would be an exciting thing for non-baseball fans to do. I don't know if it did anything or not.
But, okay, I was going to ask, did it work or not, but I guess not.
But yeah, sometimes you sort of encounter, and you know it's sales-driven rather than sort of design-driven. It's like, hey, we want to increase sales, make shareholders happy and stuff like that. So,
sure.
But my job is to make a good game, so...
Well, you certainly did with Moonstone. I the last thing I normally ask guests is, and this is going to be an interesting one for you, what's been your proudest moment in all of your gaming creation history?
Proudest
doesn't have moment. To be Moonstone.
Yeah, it's definitely Moonstone. But, you know, it's kind of like asking what's your favorite David Bowie song. And it's like, well, there's so many generations of David Bowie. It's like it's hard to pick one. But I would have to say, because Moonstone was sort of like a work of passion and love for that game, and it was a culmination of playing D&D with my friends and just sort of like an independent thing. So it wasn't like, so yeah, I would have to say that. And I think it was sort of sticking to classical animation styles and stuff that, so it's kind of in that world. I've certainly done other things that I'm very happy with and proud of. That's the crown right there. When I do Moonstone 2,
yes,
I want to make sure that I don't spoil it.
You've touched on a very good point where I think there are chances where if you don't get things correct and you start to stray maybe too far from the source, you can line yourself up for that, I guess, nostalgia kill where people are like, well, it's not like the original and now I hate the original. It's like, well, the original's still good. The original's still good. We can remember that.
Yeah.
But I mean, in closing, I think I don't think your name gets mentioned enough for the contribution that you and your co-creator made with Moonstone. It is one of the standout examples of what the Amiga can produce, with a joystick and a button being one of the best enjoyments that you can have. With modern gaming, you've got this control pad, this behemoth that has got 1,001 different buttons on it that all do certain things. But when you bottle Moonstone down to it, it's a joystick and a button, right? And the rest is made up in the game. And with that alone, it's why it stands out in my mind. The attention to detail with the animation, the story, the creativity with some of the elements that you add into there, as well as the storytelling. And each time you play it, something different happens. And that gives you a perfect reason to go back and play a game. There are too many examples in modern day gaming where you pay, especially now, 40, 50, 60 pounds for a game. Yeah. And when it's done, it's done. But games like Moonstone, and there are a plethora of games, great games on the Amiga, where it doesn't matter how many times you play them or how many times you die in them, you always go back to replay them, because it's those little fine touches of having a different experience of every single gameplay that make it brilliant. And for me, and probably the rest of the Amiga community, you know, you've done a fantastic job. And I can see the poster behind you on the wall, and I want one for myself. You know, Moonstone will always, always have a place in my heart. And whenever you make this remaster, remake, whatever you want to call it, I'm absolutely certain it will be a success. And I really hope that for the lack of exposure that it got worldwide, that the remake is the thing that finally pushes it out to the masses and people finally get to experience it all, because it massively deserves more attention than it's currently got.
Oh, thank you. Yes, that's very kind to say. I'm happy that it found the audience, be it over time or not. Like, I'm just thrilled that I've received letters and sort of like yourself from people like just saying, hey, I love this game. It's like being from Brazil, South America, throughout Europe, Turkey, Asia, and even some Canada, US, not so much. But ironically, well,
we need to change that. We need to change. We need to change that. We need to get it more into the US market.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's right. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, but I know the roots of the game is primarily England and Europe. It's like, although a lot of people are totally into these, like Lord of the Rings and stuff, so here, so definitely, yeah, it's got an audience just untapped yet.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, D&D has had a huge resurgence, especially in the last 3 years. In fact, I actually have a funny feeling that the pandemic that happened actually helped fuel a resurgence in D&D playing over the internet. So now I'm seeing loads of people streaming their D&D sessions. I'm seeing loads of people doing it digitally in calls similar to what we're doing now. I'm seeing people meet up. It's crazy how it has completely reignited that. And I think if you time this right and you market it right, you could massively tap into that. And, you know, who knows? Maybe we're going to see Moonstone, the D&D kit.
That would be amazing.
Some figures and stuff like that. Well, you know, stranger things have happened, right? And I think that the sky is the limit with this type of thing. And, you know, Moonstone has always been something that's fascinated me because of the lore, the story, and as I said, the unpredictability of knowing what you're going to face next. And, you know, I see massive scope in it, and I'm so happy to hear that you're working on a further development on Moonstone. So if people aren't already excited, they bloody well should be, because I'm like a little kid here going, just give me it now. Just give it to me, Rob. Just give it to me. But, you know, maybe I'll do another stream of it on Twitch in the near future and relive those old days. But in closing, thank you so much, Rob. It's been mind-blowing in some of the things that you've told me. It's been a massive exposure to the industry, the impact that you've had. And again, I thank you so much for your time. One thing I would like you to put in the game is all of the drawings that you've done. If there's like a gallery section that you could flick through where people can see how the artwork was made, and I think that would be a really nice touch. It's a nice thing. And I think the Turrican anthology, they didn't include anything like that. And I was like, why? You've got an anthology, put this stuff in, because sometimes it's nice, I know, albeit digitally, it's nice to just see things have started from, because people just go, oh, well, it's a bunch of sprites, you throw them on the screen and off they go. But if they can see that historical build-up, you know, you may want to watermark them as much as you want, but just seeing those pieces of art digitally and having a full understanding of where it's come from, I think just enables people to have a lot more respect for it, as I do and many other people do.
I will. That's actually a great idea, because I did send Rob Taylor, for all his work, I sent him some of my original, one of my paintings and several of the animation cells to him. So he's put them up on his wall there, so.
There you go. You better go and call him back now, because you're going to have to go and put it in your remake.
No, I scanned him already, so he can
good
keep
job.
Them.
Good yeah. job. Good job. Yeah. Well, anyway, thank you so, so much, Rob. For anyone who wants to learn a little bit more about Rob, or send him a tweet saying, hello, thank you for making Moonstone, all of his details will be below in the show notes or whatever platform you're using. If it's on Spotify or any other of those platforms, it will be there. On YouTube, it will be probably one of the top pinned comments. But anyway, from me, Mean Machine Dean, and from Rob, thank you so much, Rob. You can wave if you want. There we go. He did it. He did it. I didn't have to tell him. That's brilliant. Thank you so, so much, Rob. It's been brilliant. Mean Machine Dean, signing out. Take care, everyone. Hi there, Dean here. Hope you enjoyed that episode. Make sure you add this podcast to your favourites on whichever podcasting platform you use and give it a positive review. Until next time, Mean Machine Dean, signing out.